I mean, there's that sense that what Miles is doing at that time is almost heading toward a self-generating music, where you hear these sort of small accretions, just the repetition, but with small changes. You feel like it the music could just go on forever.
Well, the band in the 70s, I think, was a band where he just enjoyed hearing these guys play because they had no idea what they were trying to play what they thought Miles Davis wanted to hear. Mm-hmm. And Miles Davis just wanted them to do that.
Yeah.
He'd never heard it before. I think he was just trying to hear stuff he had never heard before.
Yeah. Now, you're a saxophone player, I know, as well as being a composer, but do you know, was the trumpet that Miles Davis played, I never read anything about this, and I don't know whether it's
significant. Martin Committee.
It's what?
A Martin Committee.
And how about the mouthpiece? Did he play a different mouthpiece than, let's say, what Gillespie or even Armstrong or Eldridge
played?
No,
he had the same mouthpiece since high school. He was carried with that mouthpiece.
He just kept it the same cup on the thing throughout.
Yeah, it was a Heim. And he had a copy of it made and had it drilled. And when he went to where when he used the Wah-Wah in 70s, mm-hmm. he had a drilled mouthpiece.
And what was it called again? Heim?
A Heim.
Uh-huh. And he just stuck with that from the very beginning.
Yep.
Was that a standard mouthpiece?
It was the teacher, Gustav, at the St. Louis Symphony. Mm-hmm. Mark Terry played a Heim.
Oh, okay.
It was favored of the local teachers.
Okay.
Again, major cities had orchestras.
Right.
And they had youth programs, outreach programs, and St. Louis was a Midwest city, but it still had, it was not a slave state, so to speak. It was part of the, Truman had revolutionized it to some degree. It was progressive.
Yeah.
They had an orchestra program.
Yeah.
I grew up in South Carolina. They had the Jenkins Orphanage Band.
Right. Yeah.
That was their outreach program.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Herbie Hancock had the Chicago Symphony, young pianist.
Mm-hmm.
Chick Corea, Boston Conservatory, the Boston Symphony.
Yeah.
Katz had the opportunity. Domino grew up with classical music surrounding him. He had opportunities to study it and perform it.
Yeah.
Miles Davis went to Juilliard on a trumpet scholarship. Trumpet music at that time was, and that was the awakening of the great American school. Copland.
Mm-hmm.
Samuel Barber.
Yeah.
Would you call Norman Delajoyo part of that school?
Well, I don't know his name, so I don't know. I don't know his work.
He was around that time. Gina Stera, Vittorio Giannini.
Okay.
These guys had a sound, an American sound, a style.
Mm-hmm.
They had picked up on the ravaged war, you know, the refugees, and brought their own thing to it. I mean, Copeland went to Paris, studied with Boulanger, came back to the States, and her advice to him was find your own sound, find the American sound.
Right.
And he really took it to heart, and he created a sound. That wasn't what he was going to spend his life doing,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, he liked to live the high life.
Yeah.
So it became his signature.
Yeah.
But that was a sound. That was modal music.
Mm-hmm.
Variations on a shaker theme.
Right. Yeah.
Miles was there at the time. That kind of chordal harmony, the Hindemith thing, was there at the time.
Yeah. You think what Glenn Gould was doing there in those Columbia studios, hacking stuff up, bleeds into what T.O. and Miles are thinking about?
No, that was obsession.
I just saw him as a madman across
the hall. See, classical music is highly edited.
Mm-hmm.
Classical music, if you look at a master tape, has hundreds of edits.
But, I mean, Gould will write about it, though.
Well, yeah. Some people don't want to show it, but Gould wanted to get the perfect phrase.
Yeah.
And again, it's up to him. He's the artist, and he knew how to do it. Now with digital editing, man, it's easier to do it, and people want to do it more often, so mm-hmm. they can trust it.
Yeah. You think that, you know, those edits that are really abrupt and peaceful, do you think that, I'm suspecting that Miles and T.O. just delighted in being able even to hear the edits, that it had that.
I don't think that there was any emotion. I think some were,
I mean, they didn't care.
Necessary.
I mean, they must have laughed, what I'm saying, I guess, too, is they must have laughed their asses off when Martin Williams acts like he's discovered something.
Well, T.O. probably called him. Miles was not paying attention to it. If you consider the fact that he did it as a fuck you to Tony, mm-hmm. probably didn't even, like, care about it. He only played, he never played Joe's tune.
Yeah.
And he never played Peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
He only played this about that time.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
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 And that's the only thing that, you know, was really the thing that, like, moved him to some degree past Bitches Brew.
Yeah. Now, there's a real disparity at this point in his career between what's going on live, when they play live, and what's going on in the studio. And that disparity opens up at a certain point, because at one point, say the early 60s, what's going on in the studio is precisely what's going on when they play live.
No, not at all.
It's not even in the early 60s.
Oh, in the early 60s?
No, I'm saying right. In the early 60s, it's the same. What happens in the studio is pretty much what happens outside. Or,
oh, no.
In the mid-60s, a big gap opens, correct?
No. The plug nickel, the reason why it sounds that way
mm-hmm.
is because Miles was depressed. He had just separated from Francis. The band was basically trying to make him feel better.
Okay.
They were entertaining him. He was playing all of his greatest hits. He's playing everything. When I Fall in Love.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus, Yesterdays, everything. You know, just like the saddest possible tune. But 3 months later, he was in Portland, Maine.
Mm-hmm.
They were just playing the shit out of the music, and it wasn't like anything in the studio.
Oh, okay.
The studio had a unique sound, and the band on the road had a much more... The studio band had a sound was more finesse. Tony played to the studio. On the road, man, it's ridiculous. I have Gingerbread Boy at the Newport Festival in 1966. Phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And I have it with the live band playing it. I mean, the band playing it in the studio in October. Then I have it at Berkeley in 67. I have it at Newport in 67. And I have it at Plug Nickel in 69.
Mm-hmm.
Tony just becomes overwhelming, and he's already overwhelming in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. And they could never capture that in the studio. He would peak. They wouldn't be able to do it. The closest he got to it is a Country Son.
Okay.
And then Fraylone Brune.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But listen to the cymbals.
Yeah.
And when he never used the cymbals on the road that he used in the studios. He had travel cymbals, and in Europe, those bootlegs in Europe, he's not using his cymbals. He's not using his kit.
Mm. Okay. He just picks up what's local.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or Beaver Harris's drums, because they were opposite Archie Shepp.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I made a study of Tony's drum sound. And, I mean, you can hear in Paris, they have a 20-inch bass drum, or a 22-inch bass drum. It's like a big band drum.
Hmm. Well, so many jazz musicians just act as if records are an afterthought, and indeed, the economics of things would make it such. You know, if you can't make a living by issuing records, why are they even important? But Miles becomes one of those figures for whom you could making a record it becomes a way becomes a livelihood, and so he responds to them in a different way than, let's say, Charlie Parker would have. Is that you buy that?
Yeah.
You know, I think Ellington definitely worked in such a way that he thought in terms of what a 78 could do and what it couldn't do, or he thought in terms of the three and a half minute form, almost like writing sonnets. But so many jazz musicians, even up until, I don't know, even present day in some ways, don't really think of the album as a palette. And one of the things that's going on with Miles at this moment is he thinks in the terms of the medium itself, and maybe that's what makes that huge difference between what's going on live and what's going on in the studio, or that's one of the things.
Yeah, there was a certain kind of thing about live that they would play the same tunes but never the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And they got to the point where they would never end the tune.
Okay.
They would never go back to the top.
Yeah.
They would just go on.
Yeah.
And that to me is a sign that they were just interested in the performance.
Right.
Miles and Trainor are the only two artists I know of who people are fascinated with their studio stuff as well as the live performances.
Mm-hmm.
And more so with what they play live because it's just got this energy.
Yeah.
That you just, the studio stuff, it's one way. But man, when it's on the bandstand, I have a tape of them in Boston. It's ridiculous. Tony just overwhelms the band.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like unheard of today. Lenny White's trying to do with Wallace Roney, you know, to have that real full drum sound.
Yeah. And fuller than Elvin Jones.
Yeah. Yeah, because he played harder. I mean, Elvin didn't really play hard.
Yeah.
He just had dynamic range.
Right. And really, and then the rumble of those bass drums, I guess, made it seem like it was...
Yeah, well, he's trying to sound like a timpani.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. Orchestral.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are some drummers that will really... are still, again, like Elvin, totally misunderstood. Because he's a very orchestral drummer. You know, how he uses his drums.
Yeah.
Especially in the solos, because he takes the bass drum, he gets like five or six different tones out of it, and they're different kinds of things. Some of them are like bottom ends of kunga, bottom drums of kunga, and sometimes it's a timpani, and sometimes it's like a real soft jazz bass drum, and the other times it's like a military bass drum.
Yeah. Hey, let me ask you one more question. I'll let you go. I'm interested in this... The Fender Rhodes sound. I mean, it happens a little bit earlier than in A Silent Way. And
Stuff was the first time they got it to sound right.
It one of the things that fascinates me is it's almost if you hand a Fender Rhodes to Hancock, Corea, and Zawinul, it's almost like giving them an instrument that they know how to approach it as far as technique goes, but it's a brand new instrument for them, and so they're actually able to invent approaches to the instrument.
There's no rules, no boundaries.
Yeah.
Now transpose that to today with the modern era of the fact that on one keyboard you can control thousands of sounds, and you can process them hundreds of ways,
mm-hmm.
and you can do it real time if you really have your shit together.
Yeah.
There's only one guy out there who does that. One keyboard player out there who does that in the jazz vernacular.
Who's that?
Scott Kinsey.
Huh.
Yeah, he's remarkable.
Yeah.
He goes to the gig with his two keyboards and his laptop. And he has samples, and he's got a phrase sampler. And this is a sampler that you can manipulate live.
Mm-hmm.
You can store thousands, hundreds of samples, and with the laptop you can, you know, download on FireWire or USB files, at, you know, instantaneously.
Yeah.
You can real-time have a complete orchestra of sounds at your disposal.
Yeah.
And you just incorporate them as a texture, like Gil Evans, what Miles got with Gil.
Mm-hmm.
And it's out there, and cats just are ignorant of it because they're still trying to play like guys played in the 60s.
Yeah. And so people that want to play turntables, that's almost itself a kind of an antique way of...
Yeah, to me it is. I mean, we have a DJ, and he's got a vocoder, and we're buying him some effects and stuff, and he's going to get a CD player.
Yeah.
And it's just like, join us, you know?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I have a WX7, which is a woodwind controller, mm-hmm. and to me it's just like, it's just a way to create these timbres, you know?
Yeah. But the Fender Rhodes was a brand new entity.
And that particular one they were using, the first one, is called the Silver Top Fender Rhodes.
Okay.
And this was the earliest commercially available model.
Mm-hmm.
And it had volume and tremolo. And that was it.
Yeah.
Two knobs.
How do you hear those three keyboardists there? What was their relative differences? I mean, so...
Well, you can hear... Chick was basically percussive.
Right.
Chick was a rhythmic contribution.
Because he had been, what, a drummer in Boston,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And Miles always wanted Herbie. I mean, Herbie, the real story behind Herbie was is Miles, Herbie wanted to go on the road, but Miles didn't want to lose him. He was on every recording session.
Mm-hmm.
Even into, like, 72.
Yeah.
You know? Miles could not get Herbie Hancock out of his head.
Yeah.
And if you listen, Herbie's the color guy.
Right.
The color commentator.
Yeah.
And you have this just beautiful duality between guys who understand, and they play off of each other very well. Zawinul was hired basically to play bass line.
Okay.
You know, on early minor, he just softly doubles the bass line.
Mm-hmm. And when they double those bass lines, are they working with a chart so that he knows what's coming? I mean, did he...
He's got a chart on early minor.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But there's mostly sketches on Miles stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they don't need parts because most of them are just motifs.
Okay, yeah. Right. Are there things that we're going to hear in 5 years? I mean, early minor, some... You know, you write about it. It's one of the real finds of this... For the, you know, rank and file populace like me, it'll be one of the real finds of the box set.
Oh yeah.
Are there other things like that that are going to be forthcoming, or is this pretty well tapped out 1969, those 6 months?
Well, yeah, there's nothing else in there.
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
That's a lot of music.
It's a lot of music. Yeah. And when I listen to that the eight track version of Peaceful, I end up realizing why it was called The Train. You know, it really sounds like it.
Yeah.
You know, that the hi-hat going throughout the whole thing.
But see, that's why I think Silent Way is misunderstood and often criticized. Because if you go beyond the fact that they are jazz musicians, it's a jazz record.
Mm-hmm.
It is about what you will accept as a performance.
Right. And as a recorded performance.
Or as a composition.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you look at it as an entire composition, exposition, recapitulation, development, coda.
Mm-hmm.
So not a form.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all it really is. It's jazz.
Mm-hmm.
When you start getting specific, then you should get specific with everything.
Yeah.
And don't put it down because it's of what it is in its essence.
Right.
Because if you know about that form, then you can discuss that form about other pieces of music.
Uh-huh.
And then single this one out as an example of we would call a concrete version of jazz.
Yeah.
In a sonata form, which is not disallowed.
Right.
Jazz musicians are just instinctually driven to form in their solos, in the way they put music together.
Mm-hmm.
We want a finale. Younger generation people don't. The techno people, it doesn't have an end.
Yeah, I think of it in writing terms, you know, of almost these sort of, is it, you know, the analogy between Aristotelian sort of plot structures as very analogous to, you know, a diatonic sorts of composition.
Yeah, yeah, right. Climax, supply and demand,
yeah.
Yin and yang, cats and dogs. It is drama.
Right.
There's an element of drama. Popular music, good popular music, the stuff that Miles was attracted to was dramatic.
Yeah.
The popular music was Broadway shows when he got to the point where he picked his music. It was Broadway shows, popular music songs, Sinatra songs, stuff that had dramatic elements written into the melody.
Mm-hmm.
Songs that went somewhere.
Yeah.
Peaked. They had a climax. And that's a natural thing. And when it's operatic. It comes, you know, straight from Wagner. And, As the operatic forms got longer, it developed, you know, went right to Porgy and Bess. You know, the American Tin Pan Alley. You know, the Rose of Tin Pan Alley was Porgy and Bess.
Yeah.
And that was an operatic adaptation of song plugging music.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it was legitimate because it was an opera. It's just the forms were very much AABA.
Right. Right. That
30 so not Italian opera.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I did a variation of Turandot simply because Puccini by the 20s started writing longer and in forms like longer kind of form, like Nessun Dorma is a longer form. It's a great aria. But he wrote some other pieces that led, they were very beautiful, and they were like very like jazz, you know?
Yeah.
But Tosca, difficult. And I asked Gil once, you know, why they didn't do it. He said, couldn't find enough music.
Oh.
Because the melodies were very short. And then the dramatic music was like dramatic. It was really, Turandot was exotic. And Turandot was, I think Puccini didn't have to prove anything and was just writing a grand, his last grand opera.
Okay.
And so things took their time. It was very, very, you know, three acts.
Yeah.
And you had a lot of music.
Yeah. Well, how's your Black Dahlia project? You happy with the way it's
going? Yeah, I mean, well, given what's going on in today's market, I'm very happy.
Good. Yeah.
It's well, you know, it's been reviewed by lots of people.
Yeah.
And the sales are pretty consistent with what they would call a good seller in that kind of music.
That's great. Yeah. Well, congratulations on it. I admire it.
It's just, you know, sometimes you just have to do something like that, you know.
Yeah.
And you want to do it again.
Right. Yeah. Hey, listen, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I really appreciate you spending time with me. You bring great insight to this. I really enjoyed reading your liner notes. It's made me want to go out and take piano lessons. And
well, it doesn't hurt.
It sure does not. It would not.
I once confronted a New York critic. He's a friend of mine. I said, look, I'm going to buy you Donald Graff's History of Western Music.
Mm-hmm.
He said, what for? I said, so you understand how hard it was to get to where we got.
Yeah.
To realize that 151 took a millennium.
Yeah.
And then 125141 took 100 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, I tell you, I wish somebody had just... Well, I played clarinet in high school, but I wish somebody had beat me over the head when I was a kid.
Where were you in high school?
In Chattanooga.
Chattanooga?
Chattanooga, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you still hear
see,
that.
Tennessee, I mean, at that time, they had band programs.
Yeah, we had a good band program,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, yeah. But see, they looked at it as they wanted to have the best band because they had the best football team.
Mm-hmm.
There was community pride. You went to a relatively mid-sized high school?
Yeah.
Yeah. You knew all your neighbors?
We had about 1,500 students.
Yeah, we're kindred spirits.
Yeah.
You know, good high school band program. Everybody liked to go to the marching band.
Right.
Because you got to go on the road, you know?
Yeah.
And then you had competitions in the fall.
We had two all-black high schools in Chattanooga, and they marched like Florida A&M, you know?
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. We had Burke and C.A. Brown.
Yeah.
Yeah, the South, man. I tell you, it's a very common experience. It's
right.
Lost now because... The South has become colonized by industria.
Right.
Now, it's a very techno-industrious society down there. They have magnet schools to make up for their piss-poor attitudes.
Yep. I have a friend that teaches at a magnet school in Charlotte.
That's a good place.
Yeah, it is a good place.
And it's good for the students who want to go there.
Mm-hmm.
See, to me, you miss going to school with total doofuses.
Exactly, yeah. That is a key point.
You know, I mean, just the total, I mean, I went to a school where we had some of the stupidest people on earth.
Yeah.
White and black.
Sure.
And, you know, and people with names like Pee Wee Elrod.
Right. Watching the interaction of them in gym class. Yeah,
I just, you know, have so many fond memories of this. And if you go to a school where everybody is like, you know, there's not really any dumb people.
Right.
It's fun of.
That's true. I'm going to hold on to that today. That's great. Yeah.
it's something that I've taken my girlfriend down to South Carolina, and she doesn't understand what it's like being around doofuses.
Right.
Only a Southern knows what a doofus is.
Yeah.
I mean...
We had a team we played. We had a little city outside of Chattanooga, the twin cities of Soddy and Daisy.
Is this like where they're inbred?
Yeah. We thought that the whole high school was doofuses.
Yeah, we had one Chalkahatchee instead of a baseball. And they never won a game. Yeah, it's just it's a culture that's gone. Well, not always gone.
Yeah.
But with the interstate highways, I did this history of a Southern culture.
Mm-hmm.
A calendar, and one of them was National Speed Trap Week, celebrated in towns located close once a year, located for a week once a year, located that are located close to an interstate highway.
Right.
You know. And there's, let's see, Lester Maddox Day in Georgia.
Yeah.
Right. Helms Day in North Carolina. Strom Thurmond in South Carolina.
Yeah.
Faubus in,
Arkansas. Yeah.
George Wallace in Alabama.
Right.
Who's the guy in Mississippi?
Yeah, I don't know his name.
Yeah, do you know what the most polite greeting for a waitress at a Southern truck stop is? You don't sweat much for a fat girl. Do you know what the Alabama, how Alabama got its name?
No, I don't know this.
Toothless shit kicker was already taken. Do you know what Georgia State motto is?
No.
We ain't Mississippi.
At least we're not. You know what the plural of all is?
What?
All y'all.
Well, when a redneck comes up to you and says, how does a redneck use the word penis in a sentence? Well, you boys, come on here and paint this jar. How does a redneck use the word urine?
Urine, is that urine or mine?
You're in the wrong part of town, boy. How does the redneck use the word urine and asshole? In the same sentence.
I'm
You're in the wrong town, you Yankee asshole.
Did you hear about the guy that, this football scout, he's traveling the South, he sees these two guys tossing watermelons, and one's amazing. He realizes, gosh, sign this guy right now. He walks up and he says, hey son, can you pass a football? He says, I guess I could if I could swallow it.
I have a true story, and I'll let you go. The Tony Williams Band was on the road with the Benny Green Trio as part of one of these Blue Note road shows, and they were in a bus. And they were traveling through the South, and they were on their way to New Orleans. And they pulled up to a truck stop in a small area, out, you know, like in one of those places in Alabama with the all woods and dark.
Mm-hmm.
There's a truck stop, you know, and they're like, Clem, 3 miles this way, you know. And they get out of the bus, and they go in to eat. And they come out of the bus, and they notice that a truck has pulled in front of them, like a vegetable truck. And in the back of the truck is loaded with watermelons. And as Mulgrew and Ira Coleman and Wallace Roney are walking back to the bus, some cracker comes up to them and says, Biggie, you boys be following a watermelon truck.
Yeah, we call it the scent back in New Jersey.
Oh, I tell you, man. But the South, I mean, I have fun with Southerners. It's just, I have so many cousins down there. I'm from there.
Yeah.
But I escaped and I went up here.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm almost honorary Jewish up here.
It's like the guy in front of a deli not long ago, he told the guy behind the counter, he says, man, I love Jewish food. He says, you know, I was almost baptized a Jew.
Well, I can relate to that. I just think that we're in this period of time when Southern culture is, what people think of Southern culture is a white sheet. South Carolina state motto is, you know, South Carolina is OKKK. They were going to put a cracker on their flag to replace the one they had. You know?
Yeah.
But it's amazing. See, I don't know about Tennessee, but there's got to be East Tennessee and West Tennessee.
Well, there are three states. It's like where I'm living here in Pennsylvania. You know, you got a long state. You got Philadelphia, the middle of the state, and Pittsburgh. It's Chattanooga works, or Tennessee works the same
way.
Well,
you have colonial, agricultural, and industrial.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome.
I mean, Memphis is just a completely different world, as you well know, from, Knoxville or something.
Yeah. Memphis was like the southern, became like a safe haven to some degree. the sense of a safe haven.
Well, it's such a river town too. You know, it's open, it's funky.
South Carolina has a different culture. It has a deeply rooted Southern aristocratic culture.
Right.
Families tracing themselves back to pre-revolutionary times.
Yeah.
And then you have its agrarian culture, which became a low country agrarian culture. And then what happened was, as the Depression hit, Civil War destroyed the Southern agrarian culture. People fled, the working class fled north or fled west, and you were left with plantations that were slowly decaying.
Right.
And basically, it was poverty. Poor whites, poor blacks, all suffering.
Yep.
That's when the Klan came into being.
Yep.
Because it was like they were pissed off. Reconstruction destroyed their culture, which was totally unfair. What has survived is the affectations of the Southern aristocratic culture, which Charleston and Savannah play on heavily.
Mm-hmm.
And which Williamsburg has like a Disneyland version of it.
Right.
That's more colonial.
Yep.
But there is no real colonial. It's aristocratic colonial. It's not the old, you know, Puritan colonial. It's not Yankee colonial.
Right.
Yankee colonial.
Right.
The middle of the state and the upper part of the state are deep Republican strongholds.
Mm-hmm.
They're deeply Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like Bob Jones University. And the downstate is all Democrat.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's always seaport town versus the mountain, the country.
Yeah.
If you look at the map that voted for Gore, we should shut them off, you know?
Yeah.
You know, we should just decide to, you know, say all your products coming through our states are going to get taxed. But, you know, in reality, he had the entire South. Bush had the South. He had the middle. The Democrats had the Northeast, the upper, you know, the places that are cold.
Yeah.
And California, which in 4 years is going to vote Republican. You know, so here we are.
Yeah.
The modern Southern world. And
we
grew up in those varying degrees of Southernness.
Yep, yep.
Now it's just suburbia.
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah, it's its own kind of sprawl.
Yeah, how many malls do you have when you go back home?
Lots and lots.
And, let's see, what, a lot of video rental places?
Sure, yeah.
In McDonald's, Burger King.
Right.
Applebee's.
Yeah.
Shit. I mean, you can just go through the list. Chains. Mass merchandising. Mass chains.
Mm-hmm.
Every town has the same shit.
Yep, yep.
You go to South Clem, it's got a TJ Fridays.
Yeah, and a Walmart.
Yeah, but the one in West Clem is better. They have a barbecue sauce they make themselves.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying?
Where they use vinegar in it. Yes.
And I remember driving out to the country, and there would be a road sign that had this, in illiterate English, barbecue. And you stop in, and it's just like, place of this shit. And it was just rice, and pork, and ground. And it's like, okay, you know, boom, boom, boom. It's great. You sit down at the table, you bust yourself. It's like $1.30.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That was in West Clem.
Yeah. I ate in a place not too unlike that in Charlotte not long ago, and James Brown's band had just been in there the week before. And apparently they ate a whole lot of barbecue.
Man, do they do anything hip at Brevard?
I don't know. It's been too long.
Man, I went there. I had a great time there. I saw Boxcar Bertha.
Uh-huh. Scorsese's movie.
Yeah, my first softcore porn film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Barbara Hershey.
Yeah.
But, yeah, man, North Carolina. North Carolina is what we call the progressive southern state.
Right.
Yeah. Which it had a better education system than South Carolina.
Right, it did.
Or at least they told you that.
Yeah. Well,
but it generally did. And, I mean, they definitely have a better social environment than South Carolina.
Right.
South Carolina is still... Oh, man. It's very different. They just don't want people to move forward.
Yeah. Well, I wish I had enough money to move to Chapel Hill. I'll tell you that.
Really, has it become one of those?
Oh, I love Chapel Hill.
It's one of those expensive places?
Yeah, it's very expensive. But it's, you know, it's an island.
You're where, York?
No, Chapel Hill. I'm in York. Yeah.
Carolina, right?
I'm in York, Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania, I'm thinking, okay.
Yeah, just down the train line from you. You know where York is.
Yeah, I've played there.
Not while I've lived here, I don't think, though.
Woody Herman's band.
Oh, okay.
1980. Mm. Actually, we played Harrisburg right after Three Mile Island.
Did you? I didn't move here till 88. I probably saw you play at with Woody Herman when at Disney World. I was living in Florida.
I don't know if we did Disney World. We did Disneyland in L.A. We did Convention Center for a dance, and only 50 people showed up.
See, I saw Woody Herman's band at Disney World or Buena Vista when Mark Johnson was playing bass in the band.
Yeah.
That would have been, I guess, in mid 80s.
No, that was 1977.
Is that right?
And 78, yeah.
Man, I thought it was, I'm older than I thought it was. Yeah, so that's the last time I actually...
I mean, he could have subbed in the 80s, but he was on the band originally.
No, that was when I saw him. He was in the band. I saw Kenton's band one night and a bunch of people over at Disney World. Yeah.
Yeah, man, well... Hey, it's nice talking
to you. Hey, great talking to you, Bob. Thanks so much.
All right, man, no problem.
All right, see ya. Yeah. Bye.